Conversation 13. In previous talks, we've touched several times on what we look for in a church, and we would like to expand those thoughts more today.
I think I really started to consider this as what do we look for in the church was about 12 years ago. We were on a trip to Africa. We were in Ghana, and we were on a long car journey from the center, from Accra, down to the Cape Coast. And whilst we did that, we just drove through fields and agricultural areas, and there were just thousands and thousands and thousands of people working in the fields. A lot of them were women as well. And it just, in incredible heat and very poor conditions, and made me realize that I'm coming from this city center, and I'm in a nice car, which was, I was fortunate, but that our model that I had been used to and been a part of was all the time of having a big church, and wasn't just the group of disciples we were with, but I've seen many mega churches that were all in the city center, and the idea is everyone would come into the city center. And even when we were there, we saw huge bus programs of people being bused in to these city centers. But right. As you get 2 hours outside, it's not even feasible. There's no way these people could even afford to get to the city center, let alone have the time or right. The means. And it just struck me that we've got to go. If we've got a message, we've got to go to them. And then I think maybe it was a year later, I was in Chile with some very good friends of ours, Dan and Mary Allison, who are just some of the kindest, most generous, and I think phenomenal church builders I've ever actually come across. And they were taking church outside of the city to a marketplace where there were people who were homeless or very poor. And they would go there at the beginning of the day on a Saturday, it was a different day, take communion and have a worship service, and also minister to the people and help them with their physical needs as well as their spiritual needs. And I thought that is much more the picture of the church that I think is a biblical sort of model.
Taking the message to the people.
Right, rather than everyone coming in to find the message. So that has got me thinking. But so some of the thoughts we're sharing, it's not just recent, it's from what we've experienced, what we've been able to see. Mm-hmm. And then added perhaps with our own things, as we got older, finding it difficult to be in a huge central location, perhaps where things were very loud. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting time to reflect.
Today's talk is called Portraits of the Church. Now, we find many images in the Bible. One common one is the body, a very organic image, like in Romans 12 or 1 Corinthians 12, where the church is the body, and we all have different functions. And that emphasizes differences, not similarities, and yet it's complementarity as we all work together. Or the image of family, like in Ephesians 2. We read frequently in the letters about brothers and sisters. And yet sometimes we'll talk about, oh, we need to grow the church or create family or forge unity. But muscle alone cannot accomplish that. So what does that mean? Well,
I think it means a lot of times that numerical growth or something getting bigger doesn't necessarily measure what it is for spiritual growth. I also think of when we talk about creating family, those of us who've been fortunate enough to have children, when you add a member of the family or when you have a birth, it really changes the dynamics. It makes it very, very different. And we've got to consider that when we're always talking about growth.
Right. Not to say that growth is undesirable, but the whole system changes and we need to make sure we're taking care of people. Well, the image of the body, the family, the flock, John 10. Well, it's not just, that's where Jesus says, I'm the good shepherd. It's not just there in the Old Testament as well. God's people are portrayed as sheep, which is sometimes a good thing and sometimes not.
But I do think one of the things, and we shared a talk about this, about John 10, about being what is a good shepherd, and is remembering that picture that the shepherd is there to make sure the sheep are safe, they get food, and they get water.
Right. A fourth image is a building, the church's building. We read, you know, Christ is the chief cornerstone. You know, there's a foundation that's been laid, but a building, which may bring to mind bricks and mortar. Paul says he's a church builder. He speaks of Apollos and he builds carefully, or you can build shoddily. Building carefully is represented by building with precious stones, silver, or gold. Not so good work, that's with straw, hay, or wood. 1 Corinthians 3.
Yeah, and that it there's that sense that it's also going to be tested as well. Buildings, I think for me, I've thought a lot about Matthew 16, when Peter is told that he's got the keys to the kingdom and that the church is going to be built on the rock. And mm-hmm. I think that when I look at my own life sometimes, this has been perhaps something that's caused a little bit of confusion. I think sometimes this passage has been used to say, the kingdom is the church, because this is what Jesus, you know, left Peter right. with the instruction to do. And I think when we're talking about a portrait here, I probably have a bit of a question, Doug, is what does it mean for something to be a key to the kingdom? Because I think we often will go back to seeing artwork with Peter with these big, complicated keys around his waist.
They're
and
huge.
He's going to unlock it.
Okay.
Or else we think of keys today, because we've got to remember, we've got to think, what did that mean to people in Jesus' time? But we'll think of keys today. Getting into a house, and keys are often, are they to unlock or are they to guard? I think today we think of keys a lot of times of to keep things out.
Right, we need to open up the church, not close it in. And I think it's an allusion to Isaiah 22. With some officials, one not so spiritual, who's going to be replaced by another. And the implication is that the leaders of Israel will be replaced. But we think of buildings and keys and structure. It's easy to read into Matthew 16, on this rock I'll build my church, an institution or maybe even a literal church building.
Right. And I mean, I would just want to say, well, what is it in Matthew 16? What is the rock? What exactly
well,
is
course,
that referring to, do you
the,
think?
The Catholics would say Peter is the rock, and that's the papacy. And Protestants would say, well, no, the rock is the confession, or it's the understanding of who Christ is. I think it is a wordplay, but I'm not convinced by the Protestant argument that Jesus is not suggesting that Peter is the rock on whom the church is built. But there's a big jump from that to the papacy, to say he's going to be the main leader, or he's going to give direction, or he will be chosen to speak the first sermon that births the church at Pentecost. I'm not sure the Protestants have it right either.
But this profoundly affects our thinking when we think of a portrait or an image, because
yeah.
we'll think of today, as we go through cities or, you know, we go through places, we'll typically find a high place in a city that's rocky, and on top is a huge cathedral. And so that creates an image for us
yeah.
that this is the structure that we need right. to be shooting for.
Now, you and I, we like to go to cathedrals. We like the art, the architecture, you know, it can be kind of cool. When we think of architecture, though, we may think of a blueprint, especially because cathedrals were so labor-intensive. And in the restoration movement, blueprints and pattern-seeking is very common. And, you know, let's exactly replicate what the apostles did. And then some would say, well, there are only four things you can do in church. You know, there's a preaching of the word, there's a fellowship, there's Lord's Supper or prayer. Or you've got what are called the acts of worship. You can take up a collection, you've got communion, you can sing, have a message. And, you know, if it's not in that list, it's forbidden. But what kind of blueprint do we see for church in the Bible?
Well, I think that's, again, that's a really great image, isn't it? Because we think of having the blueprint. Something I've heard quite a lot recently is that the Sermon on the Mount really is the blueprint for Christian or
right.
for holy living. And it's not so much about that structure, but it's more about our own infrastructure
right.
and spiritual worship.
Restoration churches tend to go to the book of Acts or maybe some other New Testament passages to find out what's authorized so that they can exactly restore the pattern. But really the only pattern we should be worrying about is, are we being conformed to the image of Christ? The pattern, the blueprint would be Matthew 5-7.
Right.
It's about character and relationship, not structure and organization and position. Yeah.
I think that, you know, that idea of really being built on the words of Jesus makes a lot more sense, and that's the
sure.
rock. You know, in the Old Testament, the rock, when Jesus is talking about the rock, the word he uses is to help Peter, I think, and to help them understand that it is the the foundation. It is the...
Yeah, but at the same time, Peter is going to be the so-called Prince of the Apostles, at least for a while, till Paul comes along.
He is. But one of the things that I think is quite amazing is that this is before, right after this, Peter also gets an incredible correction from Jesus. We know later on, Peter denies Jesus. But we see an amazing relationship, I think, with Peter and Jesus, that at John 21, we see Peter jumping out of the boat. He hasn't got everything squared away with Jesus yet. And it's so relational. You see the mercy and the grace, but you see Peter having forgiven himself. He's not down on himself. And just this whole dynamic of how Jesus relates to him makes him feel special. Clearly, Peter has done wrong, but there is this forgiveness and mercy and understanding of grace that I think that's the kind of relationship Jesus wants us to have with him.
Right. So in the church, it's about relationships and grace. It's not about buildings. We're on that building image. You know, people say, well, the church is the assembly. The Greek is ekklesia, which in early Christianity translated the Hebrew kahal. Kahal is the assembly in the Old Testament. And yes, they both have to do with assembling. And I guess you could say if you never join the body, you don't assemble, you're not part of the ecclesia. But you could be a member of the church, whether you're assembled or not. We have this image of it being a big assembly, but church tends to take place in smaller locations. Would you agree?
I think, yeah, when we're talking about like on the Sermon on the Mount, you know, that is in a smaller location. It's very hard to do in a very large situation. And again, this is what Jesus was referring to as this rock, isn't it? This kind of assembly would be built on something solid.
Jesus is dismantling the temple system.
That's interesting, because he says it's going to physically come down.
Yeah, the physical aspects will come down, and in terms of priesthood, there'll be no more priesthood. And I wonder, have we attempted to rebuild it, to rebuild a temple system and hierarchy? Something I think of often.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I also think that this is a lot of time where people are talking about perhaps deconstruction. They're talking about their faith, trying to pull down this structure or reassess this structure and how it's affected them in their walk with God.
Right. So it's like, you know, disassembling a building a bit with a wrecking ball, which I don't recommend.
But on the other hand, there are different ways to, can we say, deconstruct. I mean, you can take, sometimes we see this with old buildings, it's taken down brick by brick, and then the job is to chip off the mortar, but then to reuse those building blocks in a way.
So we've had the image of body, family, flock, building. A fifth one would be the vine. Jesus says he's the vine, and we remain in him. This is another very organic image. And commonly, the Old Testament people of God are depicted as a vineyard. For example, the parable of the vineyard in Isaiah chapter 5. But you'll find that vineyard language in the Old Testament a lot. And Jesus picks it up in his parables and also in John 15 when he says, I am the vine, you are the branches.
I think for me, currently, this is one of the most creative ways to look at how church is maybe more horizontal than vertical and hierarchical.
What do you mean by horizontal?
Well, when I think of a vineyard, and I'm trying to think of the picture that even would be in Jesus' day, is the branches spreading out horizontally.
You've never seen a 200-foot high grape tree?
I haven't. That may be somewhere, but no. Not on my travels. But and I think of how it's not necessarily the rootstock, but how, you know, in a vineyard you go back to that root, and that's what gets planted. And then it's the branches grow out vertically rather than how tall can it get. And that you see that a lot with vineyards or with fruit trees. If you want to get growing up really tall, it's not advantageous.
Right. Picking up on that horizontal vertical thing, many people are fond of a pyramid, kind of a hierarchy. You may have heard of a discipling pyramid.
Originally, or a discipling tree, perhaps.
A tree. A hierarchy really means leadership by priests. I mean, archon is a leader, hieros is a Greek word for priest. Now, when we think of hierarchy, we tend to think of multiple levels of control. And, of course, I think the two are connected. But that would be very different to the horizontal vineyard, the vines growing on the, along the ground. But some people would go to Exodus 18, where Jethro advises Moses to delegate, to devolve some of his power. Groups of, what does he say, 1,000 and 100 and 50 and 20 and 10. And they'll say, well, that's the, that's our authorization, or our, that's our pattern. And we can have quite a tall structure that is many levels of hierarchy. I don't think that works.
Well, I think it also ties in with a lot of the way of our world's business thinking today, which is very much that pyramid system. As well, is that, that you know, you and the ambition to be CEO, CFO, COO, you want to be at the top.
Right. And, you know, if I think of pyramids, these were built, and I may be stretching a bit here, but these arose around the world in a number of different countries in the Western Hemisphere and the East, but Egypt maybe is most famous. Pyramids are built for pharaohs. These are, the idea is that they'll have a great afterlife. They're incredibly labor intensive and massively well equipped, the wealth that was buried with them. Even servants sacrificed and buried with the pharaoh. It's all about
him. Or
even
family members, I think, got buried too.
Yeah, your
too.
Wives.
Alive. I mean, that was awful as well.
So a pyramid may conjure up the image of wanting to get to the top. Of course, that's not maybe the original sense of it. But we, you know, when we were talking earlier today, you mentioned the ziggurats of Genesis, like the Tower of Babel, where people are trying to make a name for themselves, and that is the priests who want control. And it was believed at the top of these towers, it's a kind of step pyramid, that the gods would come down and would meet with the priests. You know, they wouldn't be meeting with the common person, but it seems to be very much a control thing, at least to me.
Well, and it does, but also God wasn't pleased with that. And he, in a sense, we then start to see God dismantling that. I mean, he's taking down the pyramid structure here a little bit.
Or at least they're abandoning it because he's making it impossible for them to understand each other.
And that's when, you know, it's clear that there's confusion. And I think that's where a lot of times, that's where I found myself, to be really honest, a little confused is, what's the way forward? I know we need to be a part of a body and we need to be functioning, but this big structure in the center of the city isn't working right now.
Well, I don't know who said this originally, but if you take a hierarchy, think of all the levels of the height, you know, the vertical, and you flatten it out, what do you end up with? You end up with a network.
Right.
You know, relationships.
And I like to think of that vine, really, that horizontal being a network. And as the branches go out from one plant to another, they will connect. And going back to John 15, we find that God is the gardener. And so the work of keeping it in shape and in trim is up to God, not up to some other.
No, we are his fellow workers, though. Now, maybe we can think of more images of the church in the Bible. I mean, there are other images.
There was the tabernacle, wasn't there, and the temple. So those are probably two that they would have been very familiar with.
Right, and there's a kind of a continuity between the two. In the second century, one writer spoke of the ark as the church. You need to stay with the mother church. Don't get out of the ark, you'll drown. And, you know, that makes sense in a way, unless you're just saying it's your institution. A prominent image for church is found in the book of Revelation.
Right, as being the bride.
The bride of Christ. So there are multiple images, and different portraits capture different truths. You know, the body, the family, the flock, a building, a vine. And we're not saying that these are all, but we're giving a good, I think this is a good representation of these images.
Well, I think how, for me, having a picture, an image, a portrait is so important to, you know, I love doing jigsaw puzzles, but if you don't have the picture on the box, it is incredibly difficult to put it together. We think in words. We think in pictures. I think in pictures for sure.
I'd like to come back to the household image. This is I get partly body and family, the first two we looked at, but the household image. Now I know some people think, but it's not as interesting when you're in a small group. We want a show. And some people would prefer even to think of the church as an army or a multinational corporation. But we'd like for just a moment to focus on the image of church as home. Now, some big churches will say it's home. They may say welcome home or give you a very warm welcome. It may actually feel very good. But, I mean, what I'm referring to are groups that are simply too big to gather in a home. But we wanted to, we've talked a lot about a house church, a small group, something similar to that.
Well, I think we've all become much more aware of meeting in small groups. You know, COVID sort of really kicked that off for a lot of us. But I think it's also through travels we've seen that you cannot keep going into one big location. It's just not doable for the most of the world.
You know, since Ron Highfield published his book, Rethinking Church, I love the subtitle, A Guide for the Perplexed and Disillusioned. Since he published that a few years ago, I've been promoting it, and I reread it last week, and it's got so much great stuff. And his central thesis, I'm persuaded by, that we have church and parachurch swapped or inverted. You might say, what's parachurch? Well, para means on the side of. So normally we think of the church as this is this big group. Think of a large ball or large circle. You've got this little circle, little ball. We'd like you to join one of those. You know, that'd be a good thing to do. Don't just come Sundays and Wednesdays. Go to that little group. And so that's on the side, whereas real church seems to take place in the small group. It's very hard to be intimate when you're in a big group. And so it's the opposite. What we call church is really parachurch. It's the institutional church that's the parachurch, and it's a small group that's really church.
Right. And I think I've heard the call so many times when you're talking about the big church, you know, the central worship idea. You know, don't come and be a spectator. But that's very much what happens, because it's a lot of times it's performance-based. Because it's large, how are you going to corral that big
group?
Well,
you're in a theater with the sound system. You've got an usher seating you, and it's very much like a theater in some ways.
Yes.
Now, what Ron Highfield does, and he's a great guy at Pepperdine University, his point is that what makes the small church, house church, work are just the essentials, what it takes to be a church. In the course of church history and most denominations, so many non-essential things have been added and made tests of fellowship or made, you know, I don't know, absolutely central. But the non-essentials are very few. And he focuses particularly on a group of people who've been baptized, who take the Lord's Supper, and who, through whom God works, bearing witness of the gospel. Very simple.
Right. And I think that's just our tendency, isn't it, in human nature, to add layers and add complexity and make it run parallel. And we think then that becomes the core.
And of course, these things may be well motivated. There's nothing wrong with having a children's ministry or a cycling program or, opening up a soup kitchen. And larger churches will often have dozens of programs, some even 100. It's not that these are bad, but those should be the things on the side. What is central is knowing, and you can really only know a small number of people, but in that kind of home setting, being related, that's where the Spirit is going to work and change our hearts. Good?
Yeah.
So I'd like to read a quote from his book, Rethinking Church. And this is where he's been talking about what is essential to the church, you know, baptism and the mission and the Lord's Supper. Highfield says, "Notice the simplicity and universal adaptability of the church. The church consists of those who believe and are baptized into Christ, whose work is witness to Christ, and who by participating in the Lord's Supper remember and proclaim Jesus' redemption sacrifice. The church travels light as it moves from one culture to another and one century to another. It does not center on a holy site, for the Holy Spirit dwells in their bodies and in their midst. It speaks in the common tongue and not in a holy language accessible only to the learned. To make its sacrifices, it needs no altars, animals, or priests. Its whole life is worship, and its prayers are its sacrifices. It needs no golden candelabra or silk robes. Its riches are good deeds, and its treasures are in heaven. It can be dispossessed of all its worldly goods and lose nothing of substance. It needs no alliances and seeks no privileges from nations and empires. Its citizenship is in heaven, and it pledges allegiance only to the King of Kings. It can meet in a basilica, in a private dwelling, by a river, on a street corner, or in a prison cell. It matters not, for the whole world is the temple of God." I love the way he puts that.
I do too. And I also love that even it can be in all these different locations, but there's the sense that the church is a very hospitable place.
Right. So the home,
the home hospitality.
What an idea that the house church is real church, big church is parachurch. It's just exactly backwards. And that message has resonated with so many people before and after Ron's book came out. But I don't think either of us is saying that parachurch, that is the big church, is bad or it cannot be helpful. Right? We're just saying that the small group is where real church takes place.
Well, and I think we're wanting to say, consider the different pictures, portraits that you have. And a different picture may align better with your situation right now. And I think a lot of people have finding there are challenges with big church. I know for me, I had a sort of medical incident back in like 2008. And large, voluminous places with a lot of noise have become incredibly difficult for me to navigate.
Right.
Actually lose my bearings. It actually...
Well, you would normally stand outside or go to another building or work in children's ministry.
Well, I did because I couldn't cope with the sound, but it wasn't just me. And I think as we age, we have those difficulties. Sometimes we know so many times now, we've got people on different parts of the neurological or neurodivergent spectrum, mm-hmm. and noise is really disturbing to them, or even young children. And we have to consider all these different needs and the chaos that sometimes ensues from big church, that does not help a lot of people. It doesn't help them worship at all. It's more an endurance.
Well, especially people who are shy or, you know, sensitive to noise and or who still have their eardrums. They have them blasted out by rock concerts.
Well, a lot of times that's being dictated by what leaders like from their, you know, I think for me, when it became so loud, I remember very clearly, I used to then go home and I started listening to a lot more worship music because church was not a place for me where I could worship it. It was an endurance of could I stand the volume.
I got a decibel meter as an app on my phone and I measured the decibels, which I thought was sky high. It's so loud, I couldn't hear myself sing, let alone my neighbor. And I remember going to one of the main leaders and said, no, we're right at the limit. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, you are right at the limit. It may be legal limit, but it's not good.
Does noise really enhance worship?
So you might think that, wow, if we have things backwards with church and parachurch, if the things we're saying resonate with you, you may think that there is no way forward or God can't use us because it's so messed up. I'm not sure that's the case at all. And one thing I like about Rethinking Church, the book, is the optimism. So I'm going to read one more quotation.
Well, I think even the hope that there can be a different way. I think that's what we're trying to show.
So God directs the church to its appointed end despite its sins and errors. He uses fallible leaders and sinful people to work his will. Consequently, from a human point of view, the history of the church moves in a zigzag pattern, with a lurch to the right followed by a lurch to the left. It takes one step forward and two steps backward. Its path is littered with heresies and schisms, spectacular successes and abysmal failures. It has produced martyrs and persecutors, self-denying monks and indulgent bishops, peacemakers, and warriors. But it still exists. Christ is still preached, and sometimes the light pierces the darkness. For a moment, we see clearly what is and what could be and what will be. What then can fallible and sinful people do to reform the church today? Is it possible to do a better job today of embodying the essential features of the church in the world than we have in the past? Well, Highfield says, with God, all things are possible. We must not mistake God's possibilities for our abilities. Only with fear and trembling, Philippians 2:12, humility, grace, self-criticism, diligence, patience, thoughtfulness, penitence, and prayer, do we have hope of actually doing more good than harm for our church in our age? I think it's very well put. And I encourage you to read that book if you don't have a copy. It's not very long. It's a great thing. Well, any more thoughts?
Well, I think for me, this opens up the idea of that the keys to the kingdom that Peter as given. It's like clues, it's like indicator. It doesn't necessarily something to be unlocked. Here are the essentials, or here are some of the things that we can do moving forward. And that clearly we are on a spiritual journey, even with church. There it took, you know, Ron talks about there's a zigzag. It's gone up and down and all around. And yet we have hope because God can do these things. But if we're open to rethinking, opening our minds, perhaps changing our portrait, then we can release ourselves sometimes from the things that have encumbered us. And the idea of this, these talks, our conversations, is just let's rethink, let's open the box.
Right.
To see that there may be a different way for where we are today.
Now, in case you think we're wandering away from apostolic teaching, I think it's the opposite. I mean, the Lord said, Peter, you will bind and loose. You have the power to bind and loose. But actually, the Greek in this passage and other passages says, what you bind will have been loosed already in heaven. What you loose will already have been loosed. So through those keys and what you're opening up to the people, it's not something that's humanistic. It's not certainly not a return to the Old Testament system, but it's a revelation of God's will. Well, what happens? We see Peter preaching in Acts. We see how the apostles understood the gospel, and we get very great view in all the letters of the New Testament and in Revelation. And so apostolic Christianity is low-tech. It is based on small groups. The things that we're sharing here do describe the church as the apostles understood Jesus, which looks so different to church today, which is generally not church, it's more parachurch.
And I think as the apostles experienced church, and when we see that, you know, Paul going from different places, starting things, it started in small groups. It didn't start out in a big temple somewhere.
Well, so despite our failings, God will use us. God uses church, and we can be encouraged by that. But just coming to the big meeting, that's not so convincing anymore in our culture, not just among our young people, but many. And I think it is time to rethink church.
And it doesn't mean that not going to something means that you're not saved. And I think I know we come back to this, but so often we have been conditioned to believe that church attendance equates with commitment to Christ.
And salvation. Right.
Right.
Well, what's coming next? We'd like to tell you about the next three conversations. We won't tell you all of our thoughts because in part we're still thinking them through a bit. We don't want anything to get too long. The next two are also inspired and informed by the book from Ron, Rethinking Church. Next time, I'm going to talk about money, the way money is used, transparency, openness. What impressions do people have about the use of money and all about collecting money? Mm. I think we need to rethink this. Then we want to talk about authority in the church. What is the nature of authority? And can leaders really just tell you what to do and you have to do it? I mean, what's going on there?
I know recently there's been a lot of talk about the difference between church hurt and church abuse, which comes under the authorities as well.
Yes.
And it's topical. It's something we need to have a conversation about.
And then we also want to have a conversation about a fellowship and particularly circles of fellowship. Now, for these next two conversations, you'll need to log in. We know that a huge number of you are already members. If you're not, please become a subscriber. It's only $3 a month. I mean, you pay annually. And we set it at that level when we started this 15 years ago, really so that everyone would be able to do it, even people who were unemployed. Now, if you live in the developing world, and perhaps you only make a few hundred dollars a month, please feel free to seek sponsorship because many people who support our ministry would be happy to help you. But just sign up, please, so you can hear all of the conversations. And with the notes in this conversation, you'll see a link to Ron Highfield's book, plus a couple of other very interesting things to get you thinking.
And I think also if we've touched on something here, we have reached out through on the webpage, through Fair Havens, the ministry there, that some of us may want to have further conversations and discuss this. Please reach out to us through that.
Right. If you don't know the website, I'm sure you do, but it's Douglas Jacoby or DouglasJacoby.com, and you'll see Fair Havens on the sliding banner at the top. Well, thank you so much for listening in. It's been enjoyable. And next time, we'll be talking about money and what God really expects, how he really wants us to use our money. And
right.
we will be stepping on some toes. Don't forget to log in first.
All right. Goodbye for now.
Okay. Bye.